Hello, this is Peter Ott. Just a quick note before we start this podcast. My friend Lee Montoya, who designed the logo for the Sports Law Biz podcast, was recently diagnosed with cancer and had successful surgery. But unfortunately, he does not have health insurance. And so a group of friends have set up a GoFundMe page for him to help offset some of the costs of his surgery, which was quite expensive. So if you do have any means and are willing to contribute to that, you can go to his GoFundMe page. I'll post a link on the blog, or you can just go to GoFundMe and search for Lib Montoya. That's Lib Montoya. Anyway, thanks for that, and now let's get started with the podcast. Welcome to the Sports Law Biz Podcast, dedicated to helping people better understand the law and business of sports. I'm your host, Peter Ott, and we've got a lot to talk about here today, so why don't we just jump in? Hello again, this is Peter Ott with the Sports Law Biz Podcast. I'm here to talk with Jeff Tiedemann about an article that he wrote. It was published in the Sports Lawyers Journal, the Spring 2014 edition, Volume 21. It's entitled MLB International Player Draft, Home Run or Headache? So it looks at the possibility of incorporating some kind of player draft for international players in Major League Baseball. So he's here with me today. He's graciously agreed to take some time to talk about this, and let's just start off with an introduction. It's probably best if you introduce yourself, Jeff.
Hey, Peter. Appreciate you having me on. Like I said, my name is Jeff Tiedemann. I am originally from Omaha, Nebraska, where I grew up a big Cornhusker fan like the rest of the state. From Omaha, I moved on to St. Louis University for undergrad. I was an accounting major there, and then eventually made my way down to New Orleans to Tulane University for law school, where I received a certificate in sports law. The program was really beneficial for me, obviously, in the legal sense, but also just in terms of furthering my career in sports. I never really anticipated or had the goal of working as an attorney, per se. My goal really is always to work for a front office for a professional baseball team. Professor Feldman, the director of the program, really put me and the rest of the students in the program in a great opportunity to succeed, not only based on the curriculum they provide, but also the opportunities outside of the classroom in terms of internships and connections and everything else. So I guess just on that end, a few of the opportunities I had while I was at Tulane, I had a number of internships in the New Orleans area. I had legal internships with the general counsel for the Saints, as well as the Pelicans. I worked in the front office for the New Orleans Zephyrs, who are the AAA club in town there. And then I also spent a summer with Relativity Baseball, which is an agency outside of the Chicago area. In addition to those internships, I also was blessed with the opportunity to be the chair of the baseball arbitration competition that Tulane Law hosts every year. We had about 40 teams comprised of law students that come in from across the country. And so my primary responsibility as chair was to write mock problems for arbitration-eligible players, and then to grade the papers and reports that the different schools send in, and then in addition to that, to reach out to different executives and agents throughout the baseball industry to have them come in and act as mock arbitrators. So it was a great opportunity just to learn about arbitration in general, the specifics, to see different opinions from really smart law students from all over the country, and to really make connections within the industry by bringing in those different executives. So in general, I couldn't have asked for a better education at Tulane. So it's put me in a position where I am today, which is since January, I've been working as a baseball operations intern with the Cincinnati Reds. And that job title comes with different descriptions and duties just about every day. But I work primarily within kind of the lens of scouting in terms of I do a lot of work with our advanced scouting reports before each series. I work with our international scouting reports, organizing and cataloging those. I also do some work with BATS, do the video program to do some video scouting for pro players and minor league players. And then just in terms of the day-to-day, just a lot of the administrative type work that goes into the draft and trade deadline and arbitration and everything else. So it's been a great, I guess, 6 or 7 months that I've been there now and learning something new every day. And it's really great to be a part of the organization.
That's great. It sounds like you have some really interesting experiences so far in your young career, and the opportunity to go to Tulane Law School, and especially with your interests, already knowing kind of your goals, that I think that's the perfect place to be for your goals. And so that's great. Yeah, I've actually also participated in that arbitration competition twice. And
I thought you looked familiar and sounded familiar when you first reached out to me. So it's good to see a familiar face.
Yeah, no, it's great. I didn't get very far, but I did have a great experience both times. And if anybody listening to this is interested in competing in that, I strongly encourage you to try and do that. It was a great experience, and I got to meet a lot of lot of great people, hopefully some of whom will be on this podcast down the road.
Well, if you didn't make it very far, I would have to assume that Nick Kroll, my current boss as director of baseball ops for the Reds, must have been your mock arbitrator, because he's a pretty tough grader. But
yeah, no, he was one of my graders, he was pretty tough. Okay, so thanks for that introduction. Now let's move into kind of the meat of this podcast. Sure. I said earlier that your article that you wrote in the Sports Lawyers Journal, again, it's entitled MLB International Player Draft, Home Run or Headache. It looks at it kind of practical and, you know, operational aspects of Major League Baseball, and I think that's great. So if you could give us just kind of a background of what your article is, and then we can go into the details from there.
Sure, Peter. So the international draft has been talked and bandied about by MLB for years. Bud Selig was a large proponent of the idea. And really, with over the last 25 years, the number of international players within the game has more than doubled. With this increase in talents and the increase in the international focus on international scouting, so too has there been an increase in the leverage power and bargaining power of these individuals. And so what you're starting to see was just huge multi-million dollar deals handed out to these players, to the point where it was in a little bit of an excess. And so owners and club executives have discussed the possibility of having a draft as a way to regulate this spending to an extent as well, to kind of put all teams on an even level. So the goal of the paper was to kind of look at, would this be feasible based on the current rules and regulations within the game, as well as to look at any potential legal ramifications that could arise by trying to create such a vast structure for when you have so many different countries involved with different politics and everything else. So I think we'll kind of delve into that here, but really the goal was to look into the potential international draft and whether or not it would be feasible.
Okay, great. So let's start off from a really basic level. I think some people listening to this podcast might say, you know, baseball already has a draft, right? Teams draft players every single year. Why do we need an international draft if there already is a draft? And can international players not be drafted through that draft?
That is correct, to an extent. I guess whatever you want to classify international. Under the current structure of the amateur draft, players from the United States, Canada, Puerto Rico, and other U.S. territories are eligible for the draft, whereas all other players from other countries become international free agents and so are not eligible for the amateur draft.
Okay, so whereas U.S.-born or Canadian-born players could be drafted out of high school or in college, foreign players don't go through that process currently and instead are just free agents.
Correct. And okay. By being free agents, that is where they gain their primary leverage and bargaining power, because rather than only having one team to negotiate with, like domestic players in the amateur draft, they have all 30 teams in which they can negotiate a potential contract with.
Okay, yeah, and I think most fans of baseball will be familiar with that in the situation of players like Tanaka or, you know,
correct,
other baseball players who are able to get big sums up front, whereas American-born players kind of have to go through a process before hitting free agency.
Exactly.
Okay, so now let's talk about international free agency. That's the current situation that exists. How does that operate? Is it complete free agency that people can sign whoever they want, or teams can sign whoever they want?
Yes, but with many stipulations. So essentially every July 2nd is when the free agent international signing period begins, and that's open to all players 16 years or older. So these players can negotiate with all 30 teams. And one thing that has changed somewhat drastically since the most recent collective bargaining session in December of 2011 is there's been a bonus pool cap put in place for each of the 30 clubs, which was at least meant to regulate the spending of these teams. So the international bonus pools themselves are similar to that of the amateur draft, but they're on a slightly smaller scale. In terms of dollars afforded to each team, it's once again based upon how the team finished the year before. So the worst team gets the highest bonus pool, so on and so forth. So this past year, Arizona had the number one pick in the draft. They had the worst record last year, and they were afforded $5.4 million to spend on all players in the international market. And keep in mind that this does not include any players signed for $10,000 or less. You can sign as many of those players as you'd like. So the goal of these bonus pool caps was to regulate the spending by these teams, as well as to suppress the amount that teams can spend overall on a certain particular player. But really, this hasn't had any sort of effect at all, a positive effect that they thought it was going to have, because you'll see in this most recent signing period between July 2nd, 2014 until this year, teams like the Yankees, Red Sox, Angels, they all spent upwards of 100 to 250% overage over their pools. And this comes with penalties of their own. Currently, if you go 15% or more over your bonus pool cap, you lose the right to sign any players for more than $300,000 in each of the next two signing periods, in addition to having 100% tax on the contracts you sign. So for example, this past March, the Boston Red Sox signed Yoán Moncada to a $31.5 million contract, but the actual price they paid was $63 million due to the 100% tax that was placed upon them for going more than 15% over their bonus pool. And this is obviously not even to speak of the fact that they also can't spend more than $300,000 on any players for each of the next two signing periods. So in essence, you would have thought that this would be a big detractor from signing players, these huge lucrative contracts that were the reason for these bonus caps to begin with, but it hasn't had that effect at all. And the Yankees spent about 5 to 6 times their amount last year that they were allotted in the bonus pool. And so teams are willing to just go all in on certain years or a certain player and then punt essentially on the national pool the next 2 years. They feel the talent that they're seeing in any given year merits that action.
Okay. So the current system does little, it seems, to deter this kind of overspending that the bonus pool is set up to prevent. And so that's why some people, including you, have suggested that it would be necessary to implement an international draft to deal with these issues.
That's correct. And one other point, too, just on going back to the international pool as it currently is set up, not only is it necessarily unfair to those teams that can't necessarily afford a Yoán Moncada with that sort of signing bonus, it also is somewhat unfair to the players, because if you look at an example of like a Hector Oliveira, who signed for $62.5 million, meaning the amount the Dodgers paid to Oliveira is nearly identical what the Red Sox paid for Moncada, yet half of Moncada's payment goes straight to MLB as a tax overage versus Oliveira, which all goes back to the player. So it's really unfair to the two players to have, when in essence, Moncada's 10 years younger, he's viewed as a better player than Oliveira, yet because of the fact that he was tied to the signing bonus pool as an amateur player versus Oliveira, who is a professional in the Cuban League, Oliveira then gets to receive all of his bonus, whereas Moncada receives a smaller one as a result. So it's not fair to these players who are losing leverage and bargaining power simply because of their age and circumstance at that time.
Okay, thanks for sharing that. That's an interesting issue. Now let's move into looking into some potential problems with implementing an international draft. It seems that there's benefits, certainly to the teams, and also, as you just mentioned, potentially to some of these players by implementing this draft. It hasn't been implemented, and so there appears to be some logistical issues. And so if you could address some of those, what are the issues preventing Major League Baseball and the Players Association from just saying, yeah, this is a good idea for everyone involved?
Yeah, so without even taking legal ramifications within the consideration, just on the logistics side from Major League Baseball, there are quite a few issues that would have to be considered prior to agreeing to do an international draft. So first off would be how many drafts to take place. Would these players be combined with the current amateur players in their draft, similar to like what you see in the NHL, where it's just one world draft? In general, I think this would be a poor idea, simply because there would be too uneven of playing fields from which the players are coming from in terms of the age of these players, the type of backgrounds they have, the type of teams they've been playing for and against for the last several years, not to mention the lack of proper fallback options that some of these Dominican players have. So really, there's a number of things that should be considered in terms of how many drafts to have. So in general, I think if you have two drafts, keep the Rule 4 amateur draft exactly how it is in the first week of June. Have a second draft, potentially right around where the signing period begins now on July 2nd. That way, the scouting schedule remains more or less the same for teams who are scouting their international players for that signing period as it is. Now they can just draft the players rather than sign them. And that way, by separating the domestic players from the international players, it'll be more equitable to all parties involved.
Okay.
So the next question then, I guess, that comes into play is which country should be involved. This becomes tricky when you start talking about countries like Cuba, South Korea, Japan, who have their own established professional leagues already. As it currently stands, only amateur players are part of the bonus pools that go into the international free agents period, whereas players who are professional in Japan, Korea, Cuba, etc., who are at least 23 years old, don't get counted towards this. And this is where we see like the difference between Moncada and Oliveira. But the issue then will come into play is, will these professional players now from these other leagues now be eligible for an international draft, or would we simply be talking about the amateur players from these countries? And if that's the case, then we're having to go into protocol agreements and handshake agreements that Major League Baseball currently has with leagues like the Nippon League and the KBO in Korea, where it is more or less accepted that neither side will take amateur players from their respective countries. And so in order for it to be equitable for all parties involved, there really should be a full worldwide draft. draft where the players from all countries are eligible. Because really, if there are certain countries that are not eligible for the draft, I think it's possible that you could see large numbers of defections from country A to country B in order to escape the draft so that you can be a free agent and have the bargaining leverage to negotiate with all 30 teams rather than being forced to negotiate with only one. So that would obviously be another primary issue. Again, I mentioned the eligibility age, whereas one would maybe think that it should be uniform for the age for both domestic and international players. It really should remain to be 16 years old simply because of the development period. The development process that goes on in these countries is so much different than what goes on here in the States in terms of currently into the amateur draft, you need to have a high school graduation certificate in order to be eligible. Whereas in a lot of these other countries, the kids either aren't going to high school or it's a totally different schooling system. And so if you were to require a high school diploma in order to become eligible for these drafts, you would potentially see something like what happened with Puerto Rico, which saw a huge decline in their number of players signed and the overall popularity of the game in general since they entered the amateur draft back in the late 1980s. Because these players now had to compete for a select number of positions against the American and Canadian players. And so there were fewer positions in which to be selected. And those kids who weren't going to high school now had few alternatives to play since they at one time before entering the draft they could be signed at 16, but now that they had to be 18, those 16 and 17 year olds now had fewer options as to where they could train and develop their skills.
Okay, and kind of tying into that, also in your paper, you mentioned that one potential problem with an international draft is making sure that there's a fallback plan for players that are not drafted. Could you expand a little bit on that?
Absolutely. So currently, amateur players in the Rule 4 draft, those players that are eligible are either high school players, players that went to at least a year of junior college, or if you went to a Division 1 or Division 2 school, went to at least 3 years of school. And so those players that are getting drafted essentially all have fallback options to either go to college to begin with or go back to school in hopes of getting drafted higher the following year. So really the only sector of the current amateur draft that do not have that sort of leverage are college seniors. And that's why you see them more times than not being drafted for $5,000 or $10,000 signing bonuses simply because they have no other options. And so you would see a similar type, I guess injustice would be a term you could use, for the international players if they were forced to go against the American players in the same draft, because major league teams would know that these players have very few fallback options, and so they would have literally zero leverage when going up against a high school player who simply go to North Carolina or LSU the following year. By having two drafts, you would somewhat eliminate the injustices that could occur by trying to compare 16-year-old Dominican player with an 18-year-old high school player out of Georgia.
Okay, so now let's move on to discuss some of the potential legal ramifications of this international draft. I think one of the main obstacles to such a draft would be antitrust issues and antitrust lawsuits brought by various parties. And so could you just talk about who could bring these antitrust suits and whether they'd be likely to be successful?
Sure. And you know, there are a few potential parties that could bring suit in this situation. But honestly, Peter, I don't think any of them really have a case to stand on. So first, I guess you just look at the international players. We're just talking players from the Dominican Republic, Venezuela, really any of the amateur players that currently are allowed to sign as free agents who would be subject to this draft. They would maybe make the argument that it would be an illegal market allocation by taking away their ability to negotiate with whatever party they so choose and forcing them to only negotiate with one team. But I mean, those sort of restrictions have been in place with professional leagues and their drafts for decades now. So I just don't see a court overturning what has already been in place for so many years. Secondly, you have your Asian countries, Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan in particular, each of the respective professional leagues, which, as we mentioned earlier, have somewhat of a protocol agreements, handshake agreements, if you will, with Major League Baseball currently, which basically says that each side will not sign amateur players so that they can continue to grow and develop homegrown talent without worrying about the other leagues taking away all the young talent. But again, even if an actual agreement were proven between Major League Baseball leagues, I think baseball could either turn to its longstanding baseball antitrust exemption, or they could simply deny it. I think it would be tough to actually find proof that an agreement exists between the two parties. Finally, on the antitrust side, maybe the Dominican government could bring forth some sort of suit against Major League Baseball simply because of the importance that baseball has on the economy of the Dominican and the amount of money that is produced towards their GDP from the sport in general, but also from the signing bonuses that these players make once they go to the big leagues. And so if there really was a large suppression in those contracts, they could maybe try to bring a suit. But because there is no agreement currently in place between MLB and the Dominican Republic in terms of how many players must be signed and at what dollar figure they would be signed, they really wouldn't have any sort of case to bring forward.
Okay, so although there's those potential issues, it appears that they're not likely to set up significant roadblocks as far as implementing such a draft.
Correct.
Well, now that we've kind of discussed these things, why don't we move on to discussing your proposal for a workable international draft? You acknowledge all these issues. Yeah, how would you implement a Major League Baseball international draft?
So, Peter, there's really, I guess, like three primary areas that MLB would have to turn to. And I've kind of addressed most of these in some capacity. But I guess just to kind of wrap a bow on the proposal in general, I think it obviously would have to start off with the diplomatic affairs and just the political side of this. I mean, you have countries like Venezuela, Cuba, countries who have had political unrest in the past and whose relationships with the United States have been shaky at times. And so in order to get all these countries on the same page would obviously take a great deal of effort from the get-go. Further, in countries like the Dominican Republic, where we haven't necessarily addressed it yet, but Buscones, who are the trainers of these players, at times there have been Buscones who have been known to take part in illicit activities in terms of providing performance-enhancing drugs for their players or making false birth certificates for their players. And so there would have to be a regulation for how these players are being scouted, who is representing them, and how they become draft eligible. Finally, in terms of from the country aspect, countries that have professional leagues such as Cuba and Japan and Korea, it would have to take into consideration which of these players are eligible for the draft, whether you make it open to all players, amateur and professional from those countries, or if you simply make it amateur players from those respective countries. So the second element would be both scouting these international players as well as developing them. One of the hardest parts of scouting on the international scene is finding the talent and finding it in one place. The baseball infrastructure in a lot of these countries is not quite as organized as it is in the United States, where you have the perfect game showcases and other areas where scouts can see a lot of talent in one place and one time without having to traverse across the country to see these players. And so I guess one step that the Major League Baseball should probably look into would to try to homogenize the scouting process in a sense that if to set up different showcases and leagues where scouts can come in and see these players, and that way all 30 teams are on the same playing field, and it really puts the players at an advantage because it wouldn't allow their Buscones and trainers to manipulate the system in any way. Because currently you see it sometimes where Buscones will even hide their players from certain teams so that those teams that they know have more money to spend and show them only to those teams so that they can spend more money on their players. And so by setting up systems like what they currently is placed in the Dominican Prospect League, setting up leagues like that in order to develop the personal and the professional side of these players, as well as to be able to do things like drug tests and be able to verify birth certificates and things of that nature, having a firmer infrastructure in place would be necessary to move forward with this. And finally, in terms of draft structure, just kind of the ins and outs of the draft itself, as I mentioned previously, two drafts would be necessary so that the international players weren't being compared to the domestic players and fighting for the same bonus pool. I think age eligibility should remain at 16 so as not to curb the development process of these players, especially considering their lack of fallback options. And finally, on any given year, clubs generally sign anywhere from 15 to 30 international free agents under the current system. So I think an international draft, which included anywhere from 10 to 20 rounds, I think would be appropriate. And for any draft eligible players that are not selected, allowing them to be undrafted free agents and then still signed with a club, but putting a firm cap on the amount that they're allowed to sign for does two things. One, it gives those players who have very few fallback options the opportunity still to sign with clubs, but it also deters the possibility of one of these players manipulating the system and intentionally going undrafted only to be able to negotiate with all 30 clubs. By putting that cap on what they can sign for, it's the best of both worlds for both the player and for the clubs.
So just to sum this up, there's a lot of benefits to come from a potential international draft in Major League Baseball. There's also some complicating factors, but it seems like over time, Major League Baseball and the players and the countries from which they hail from will be able to make this work out, and it'll happen sometime down the road. It's a question more of when rather than if. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think it's a foregone conclusion at this point. There's been a lot of momentum for it in recent years. I know Bud Selig was a big proponent of it, and I think Rob Manfred has shown in his time so far in office that he too is in favor of one. And so the next collective bargaining will take place next December 2016. And if MLBPA gets on board with it, then it could happen sooner rather than later.
Okay, so I guess we'll just have to stay tuned and see what happens there. But at least we've got a nice primer here and through this podcast, as well as your article, Major League Baseball International Player Draft, Home Run or Headache, in the Sports Lawyers Journal. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap this up?
No, you know, Peter, I think we kind of touched on everything there, and hopefully it was delivered in a succinct enough way where people were able to get something out of it. And I appreciate you having me on, and best of luck with as you continue to grow and develop your website.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure having you on. This is Jeff Tiedemann. Thanks for coming, and we'll look forward to what you have to do in the future.
Thanks so much, Peter.
This has been an episode of the Sports Law Biz podcast. This podcast is available through the Sports Law Biz website or through iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and YouTube. Before wrapping things up, I'd like to thank some people. First of all, I'd like to thank my friend Lieb Montoya for designing the Sports Law Biz podcast logo, as well as the Sports Law Biz blog logo. His artistic ability certainly surpasses mine. If interested, you can check out more of Lieb's work on Instagram and Twitter. His handle is at Lieb Montoya in both places. That's at L-I-B Montoya. Additionally, I'd like to thank the musical artist for providing this theme music that you're listening to right now. The artist is a band called The Losers. The album is entitled Young, Tough, Terrible. The track is Sports with an exclamation point. The label is Needle Drop Co. This music is available through a Creative Commons license of Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 Unported. This podcast was produced and recorded by myself, Peter Ott, and you can reach me at my personal Twitter handle, at PeterJOTT, through the Sports Law Biz Twitter handle, at SportsLawBiz, or through email at SportsLawBizBlog@gmail.com. Any feedback is greatly appreciated. If you are interested in contributing to either the Sports Law Biz blog or podcast, definitely reach out to me. I love to talk to people about these issues, and I know I can use all the help I can get. Finally, I'd like to thank you for listening to this podcast. Hopefully it was enjoyable. If so, please spread the word and let your friends and colleagues know about it. Leave a review on iTunes. Any way you can spread the news about this podcast would be greatly appreciated. That's our episode today. Tune in next time to learn more about the law and business of sports. I'm looking forward to discussing it with you on the Sports Law Biz podcast.